On June 15, 1880, Arthur Conan Doyle wrote a vivid sentence in his diary. He wrote, "The only difference in the weather is that the fog is thicker and the wind more utterly odious and depraved." Knowing as we do that he was the creator of Sherlock Holmes, we might imagine that Arthur Conan Doyle is referring there to the thick London fog drifting outside the windows on Baker Street. But this sentence was written years before the first Holmes novel. It describes a considerably harsher environment. The thick fog and depraved wind were in the Arctic, where he traveled as a 20-year-old. Arthur Conan Doyle's journals have now been published for the first time in a book called Dangerous Work, and one of the editors is John Lellenberg. He's on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
What was Conan Doyle doing on the ship?
At the time, in 1880, he was a third-year medical student at Edinburgh University. And one of his classmates came to him and said, "I was supposed to go off for 7 months as a ship surgeon on an Arctic whaler, but I can't. Would you like to do it?" And being the kind of person he was, he did it.
And he was keeping this diary, which you have reproduced in color in the pages of this book, and the diary includes a variety of drawings as well as passages of writing.
I think there's 70 drawings in all, black and white, pen and ink sketches. In some cases, he went back later and with watercolors and went over them again.
And then it's not like this brilliant art, but it's very clear. It's very evocative art. You get a sense of being on a ship or being on an ice floe with a ship in view, and you are really, really out in the Arctic, far, far from anywhere.
He clearly saw that this experience was going to be a remarkable and important one for him. And he wanted to make the most of it and to have a permanent record in both words and art.
So they were hunting seals and also whaling, is that right?
That's correct.
Why don't we listen to some of Arthur Conan Doyle's diary? We have asked the Scottish mystery writer Alexander McCall Smith to read some passages from this diary. And here's one from April 3rd of 1880. We have a description of getting off of the boat to hunt seals by stepping from one chunk of ice to another.
"We picked the boats up soon and started packing. That's to say, all hands getting over the ship's side and jumping along from floating piece to piece, killing all they can see while the ship steams after and picks up the skins. It takes a lot of knack to know what ice will bear you and what not. I was ambitious to start, but in getting over the ship's side, I fell in between two pieces of ice and was hauled out by a boat hook."
Straightforward reporting there, but pretty vivid.
He fell in a number of times in his inexperience, enough that the captain nicknamed him the Great Northern Diver, actually a species of seabird. But it was very dangerous to do it, and the waters were freezing cold. If you didn't get hauled out immediately, you lasted about 3 minutes before hypothermia set in and killed you. And in some cases, the pieces of ice, if they came together, could basically cut a man in half.
Let's listen to another diary entry from Arthur Conan Doyle. This is from July 29, 1880, so considerably farther north than the last entry, and he writes the following.
"Came across a most extraordinary natural snow house, about 12 feet high, shaped like a beehive, with a door and a fine room inside in which I sat. Travelled a considerable distance and would have gone to the pole, but my matches ran short and I couldn't get a smoke."
We have a great deal of humor in these diary entries. And in the case of this snow house, it was just one of many things that he would never have expected or been able to predict.
Are you a fan of the Sherlock Holmes novels?
Immensely.
Well, when you start reading this diary all the way through, do you find passages, habits of writing, word choices, even characters that seem to carry over into Sherlock Holmes from this earlier time of his life?
One of the remarkable things about the diary is that although he's only turning 21 in the course of this voyage, you can already see very powerful storytelling capabilities emerging in the way he describes things. One episode in particular that basically had me falling out of my chair. It's now August of 1880. They stop at Lurik, the capital of the Shetland Islands, and he writes, "Lighthouse keeper came off with last week's Weekly Scotsman," which was the Edinburgh newspaper, "by which we learned of the defeat, the almost catastrophic defeat of a force of 3,000 British soldiers in Afghanistan at the Battle of Maiwand. And what struck me so hard about it is that 6 years later, when Conan Doyle was writing the first Sherlock Holmes story, that opens with his narrator, Dr. John H. Watson, an army surgeon, being nearly killed at that Battle of Maiwand.
And Dr. Watson's little memories of Afghanistan are sort of peppered through other novels as he goes on. It's part of his character.
It is. It's very much a physician who has had military experiences and some very severe ones as well.
There was a Sherlock Holmes story that was explicitly about being on shipboard.
Indeed. It was The Adventurer of Black Peter, and it's the murder that's being investigated is a old whaling captain who is found with a harpoon through his chest, pinning him to the wall like a butterfly to a card, Dr. Watson says.
You know, I've been flipping through this diary here that you have published in book form, and I hope this isn't a spoiler, but I'm looking at the very last entry from Wednesday, August 11th, 1880, and I just love the first sentence here. Dead calm and the sun awfully awful. Sense of humor about this guy.
Very much so. I remember there's one entry where he says, we had nothing to do and we did it. And another entry, he talks about spending the night with the crew, which is basically an evening of music, song, drinking. He says, gin and tobacco in the crew's berths. And the next entry starts, suffered for the gin and tobacco.
All right. He's reporting the facts.
He's a young man reporting what he's seen and hearing and experiencing in quite a remarkable way.
John Lellenberg is one of the editors of Dangerous Work, Diary of an Arctic Adventure, which is a publication of a diary of Arthur Conan Doyle. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
And we also heard the voice of author Alexander McCall Smith, who read passages from Conan Doyle's diary. You can read for yourself, see reproductions of that diary, and read descriptions of Conan Doyle's Arctic adventures at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. This is Fresh Air. Born in Arkansas, where he still lives today, the novelist Charles Portis is best known for his 1968 Western True Grit. But his four comic novels, Norwood, The Dog of the South, Masters of Atlantis, and Gringos, have long been a favorite of other writers as diverse as Garrison Keillor, Nora Ephron, and Roy Blunt Jr., who wrote that Portis could be Cormac McCarthy if he wanted to, but he'd rather be funny. A new collection of his pieces called Escape Velocity, A Charles Portis Miscellany, has just been published by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies. Our critic at large, John Power, says the collection reminds him that Portis is one of those great writers who never trumpets his own greatness.
Whenever I hear someone called a cult writer, my hackles jump toward the ceiling. It's not only that the phrase calls up images of self-congratulatory hipsters, but that writers who become cultish tend to do so because their work is steeped in bizarro sex, graphic violence, trippy weirdness, or half-baked philosophy. The grand exception is my favorite American writer, 78-year-old Charles Portis, who could hardly be less hip. This ex-Marine loves cars, knows guns, can't stand hippies, and lives off the media radar in Little Rock without being famous for trying not to be famous. If his name rings a bell, it's because he wrote True Grit, a sneaky dark Western that inspired two movies and was the closest he ever came to trying to write the great American novel. Yet among Portis's followers, and yes, we're a cult, that book doesn't display what makes him special. For us, thinking that True Grit is the best of his five novels is like saying Hey Jude is the Beatles at their finest. He hasn't published a book since 1991, so my heart soared when I learned about Escape Velocity, a Charles Portis miscellany. It brings together pieces that we cultists have been passing around like samizdat literature. The book's editor, Jay Jennings, has collected lots of good stuff, including Portis's 60s articles about the civil rights movement, assorted short stories, a new play, and the longest interview he ever gave. What I like most here are his travel pieces. A terrific portrait of Nashville music, a sharply drawn auto trip down Baja, California, and an affectionately droll memoir of three cheap hotels. The kind of places where you would find, he writes, British journalists named Clive, Colin, or Fiona, scribbling notes and getting things wrong for their journey books about the real America, that old and elusive theme. Of course, Portis himself works that same old and elusive theme, even if he proceeds elusively. He doesn't tackle the CIA head-on like Don DeLillo or big city racial politics like Tom Wolfe. He'd never call a novel freedom. Instead, he tells cockeyed stories filled with digressions and a Gogolian profusion of garrulous oddballs, con men like Grady Fring, the Credit King, and warp visionaries like Dr. Rio Sims, who turn up and regale us with stories of other oddball characters who they've met but we never will. And in this very looseness, Portis captures key features of our national psyche. For starters, he writes about and shares our national obsession with being on the move. His plots are quests, whether it's the ex-Marine hero of Norwood going from small-town Texas to New York City to collect some money, or the mild-mannered hero of the Dog of the South chasing his runaway wife from Arkansas to British Honduras by following the route marked out by her credit card bills. Portis clearly loves the road as much as Jack Kerouac, but he doesn't mythologize it. He knows that restless motion is part of our national DNA. So is the obsessive quest for some sort of hidden truth behind daily life. His books are crawling with gurus, self-help specialists, secret organizations, and devotees of cosmic conspiracies, like the hippies in search of Mayan wisdom in the novel Gringos, or the members of the Gnomon Society in Masters of Atlantis, who wear funny hats and think they have the answer. In Portis's America, everybody's always looking for that special piece of knowledge that will let ordinary people feel less, well, ordinary. I suspect Portis would be chagrined to have me state all this so baldly. You see, what makes his work magical is the deadpan brilliance of his language, which is at once extraordinarily observant. He notices the iridescent rainbow sheen on a slice of roast beef, and yet comically askew, so that we see the world in a way we've not quite seen it before. He's our funniest living writer, with a sense of humor so sly that you can read his best book, The Dog of the South, 5 or 10 times, and still find jokes you've never noticed before. So if you've never read Portis, here's what I'd recommend. Pick up his first novel, Norwood, and don't stop reading until you reach the scene with the sideshow chicken, Joanne the Wonder Hen, who's probably the wisest character in all his work. If you do this, I feel confident the Portis cult will have enlisted another member.
John Powers reviews film and TV for Vogue and Vogue.com. Escape Velocity, a Charles Portis miscellany, is edited by Jay Jennings and published by the Butler Center for Arkansas Studies. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Yo-Wei Shaw is doing our online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.
We have some news this morning that could come as a pleasant surprise to people who fear the Facebook generation has given up on reading. Well, reading anything longer than 140 characters. There's a new report out today from the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project. Over the past year, they've been studying the reading habits of what they call younger readers and the role of books, libraries, and technology in their lives. To learn about some of the findings, we're joined by Catherine Zekure, the study's main author. Catherine, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
You know, one of the numbers that caught my eye in this report is that 8 of 10 young people, and we should say that's 16 to 29-year-olds, have read a book in the past year. How do we interpret that?
Well, that's compared to about 7 in 10 adults in general. So they're more likely to read, and they're also a little more likely to be using their library.
And what did the younger people say when they talked about why they still enjoy getting a print book when there are e-books and other options out there?
Well, we heard from e-book readers in general how they don't want e-books to replace print books. E-books supplement their general reading habits. And we heard from a lot of younger e-book readers about how they can read when they're waiting in line for class or waiting in line for lunch. One reader in particular told us that when he has a book that he loves, he wants to be able to access it in any format. So with the Harry Potter series and the Game of Thrones series, he's actually bought all of those books as print books and as e-books, just because they matter that much to him.
And what about the library? I suppose this generation might have different needs, different demands for what they want out of their library than people did maybe 10, 20 years ago. What have you found?
Well, we found they're very interested in the idea of preloaded e-readers, being able to check out an e-reader at a library that already has some popular titles on it. And a lot of libraries are really looking at how they can engage with this younger age group, especially with Americans in their teens and early 20s. And so a lot of libraries have activities just for them. Some libraries even have sort of diner-style booths for the teens where they can just socialize and hang out, and so that they can think of the library as a space of their own.
Catherine Zekier is a research analyst at the Pew Internet Project, and she was talking to us about a new study that shows that a significant portion of the younger generation is still reading and visiting libraries. Catherine, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
And there may be a new gadget you can use to read e-books, the much-talked-about iPad Mini. Apple is expected to unveil the device today at a media event in San Jose, California. Not much is conclusively known about this product, except that if the speculation is correct, it would be smaller and cheaper than the iPad. Still, that is not stopping some companies from making iPad mini cases, even though they do not have dimensions for this device. According to Wired.com, one company unveiled their case yesterday based mostly on rumors, which means if they have the specs right, they will either be ready for customers or they'll be out of luck and out of money.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. 75 years ago, J.R.R. Tolkien released a book he originally wrote for his kids, The Hobbit.
In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. Not a nasty, dirty, wet hole filled with the ends of worms and an oozy smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole with nothing in it to sit down on or to eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort.
That's Corey Olson reading, of course, the opening lines to The Hobbit. Olson is known as the Tolkien professor, and his new book is called Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. Now, The Hobbit isn't just a landmark piece of fantasy literature. It's a movement, a cultural movement, a work that's inspired everyone from director Peter Jackson to the band Led Zeppelin to Leonard Nimoy, who even recorded his own homage to the book in the late 1960s, The Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
In the middle of the earth, in the land of Shire, lives a brave little hobbit whom we all admire. With his long wooden pipe, fuzzy woolly toes, he lives in a hobbit hole and everybody knows him, Bilbo.
And if you want to see the video of that, go to YouTube. Now, even though it's widely celebrated, The Hobbit's always kind of existed in the shadow of Tolkien's other great work, The Lord of the Rings. And Corey Olson, the self-described Tolkien professor, thinks that's a great shame.
Even people who are Tolkien fans and who really love The Lord of the Rings tend to fall in love with The Hobbit when they're children and then move on to The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion and really not go back very much and certainly not read The Hobbit with the same kind of attention and respect that they tend to read Tolkien's other work.
Why do you think that happened with The Hobbit?
Well, I think it's several things. The biggest difference, I would say, between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings is the tone and the style. The Hobbit has a narrator character who is very much more intrusive than the narrator character in The Lord of the Rings and tends to speak more consciously addressing children. And you can see, actually, if you go back and you look at the great popular children's books of the time, you know, of the 1930s and the several decades before that, you can hear the similarity in the tone that Tolkien's going for there with his narrator in The Hobbit, similar to books like Winnie the Pooh and Alice in Wonderland and Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. And you can see some very similar approaches that he's taking there, but it's very different from what he does in The Lord of the Rings.
One of the most memorable scenes in The Hobbit is the so-called riddle scene. And we actually found a clip of Tolkien reading part of that scene. Let's take a listen to it.
All right, said Uga, not daring to disagree and nearly bursting his brain to think of riddles that could save him from being eaten. There are 30 white horses on a red hill. First they champ, then they stamp, then they stand still. That was all he could think of to ask. The idea of eating was rather on his mind. It was rather an old one, too. Gollum knew the answer as well as you do. Chestnuts, chestnuts, he hissed. Teeth, teeth, my precious.
God, the Gollum is just so weird every time I hear his voice. Corey, but in your book, you actually point to the scene. This is a scene that you think represents a wider story of The Hobbit and what it was meant to be.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I tend to point to this as one of the scenes which not only I think is of really central importance to this book as a whole, but is really for me one of the clearest examples of the kind of thing that I'm talking about. That is, this is on the one hand a really good story. You can hear how interactive, how dynamic Tolkien was making it. You can tell from his reading that this is something that he conceived of as an oral performance. You know, this is something that he used to read to his kids, and The Hobbit still to this day works so well aloud. I've already read it aloud to my sons, and it's fantastic. But while this is, you know, has all of the kind of performative appeal and is really, you know, Gollum is not too scary but quite creepy, and you've got the fun of the riddle game and the kids get to try to guess the riddles and everything, at the same time, there is a lot of sort of complexity here when you look at it carefully. The riddles that each one of them choose to tell and how they express it really, when we pay attention, shows us a very clear picture of Bilbo's bright cheerfulness and Gollum's despair. It's really quite sad. But again, it's not obtrusive. It doesn't force itself upon you. You can just, you know, read it and have fun. And that's what most people do with The Hobbit.
I'm speaking with Corey Olson. He's an assistant professor at Washington College in Maryland. And he's the author of the new book. It's called Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. Corey, one of the things that I loved about this book, well, looking back on it now, is that Tolkien wrote this for kids, right? I mean, this was written,
yes.
And he didn't sort of whitewash. I mean, there were really dark themes. There are dark themes in this book.
He did, as you say, very strongly believe in that. He was born in 1892, so he grew up with a steady diet of Victorian fairy tales and stuff. And there was a trend, of course, in the 19th century to kind of gloss over that stuff. You know, Andrew Lang's collection of fairy tales takes out the more gruesome elements from the Brothers Grimm, for instance. And Tolkien was strongly opposed to this. You know, he said children aren't meant to be Peter Pans. You know, they're not meant to be just sheltered and protected from anything gruesome. They're meant to grow up. And that happens. You know, they can gain wisdom and strength from being exposed to these things and knowing that these things are out there.
This book has incredible staying power. And of course, everyone's sort of waiting for this film by Peter Jackson, which will come out at the end of this year. But, you know, you think about like Harry Potter, which is an incredible series of books. And you, I sometimes I wonder if we'll be talking about it in quite the same way we do now in 75 years. But it's 75 years since The Hobbit, and it's still a huge phenomenon. I mean, kids still read it, and adults read it, and there are movies made, and it's incredibly successful.
Yes. You know, he talked a lot about myth and the power of mythic stories, how myths, great myths, really sort of tap into things, images and imaginations and desires and people. And I think that was one of the things that he sort of one of his highest aspirations for his own stories is that there might be bits of it, that there might be elements of that kind of mythic appeal in his story. And I think that he succeeded quite remarkably in that, and that that's what I would personally attribute that staying power to.
That's Corey Olson. His new book is called Exploring J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. Corey Olson also teaches at Washington College in Maryland. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
We are about to meet a man with a powerful addiction to running, and he believes it has saved him from addictions that were far worse. His name is Caleb Daniloff, and he's written a new book called Running Ransom Road about his experiences running marathons. We met up with Caleb at a popular running spot in the nation's capital. He has run some familiar marathons, New York, Washington, Boston. Then there was the time he returned to a city where he spent time growing up, Moscow. Russia, not famous for outdoor running, and their marathon has some quirks.
The water was rationed when we were running.
It's and not so a good thing for a runner, I would imagine.
No. Well, what happened is that there was also a 10K race, and so they didn't want the 10K runners drinking up the marathon runners' water, so no one got water until after the 10K, until after 6 miles.
As if you marathon runners don't need water the first 10K.
Exactly.
And wasn't there a water station that didn't actually have water?
I got to one water station that they had, and it was like mile 23 or 22. And
you're thirsty.
Very, very. I mean, those last 6 miles, it's unslakable. You know, and then they have, you know, instead of, you know, in sort of Western marathons, they have station, you know, your Gatorade and your water,
sure.
And they have energy goo at certain stations. In Moscow, they had this table, and they had all this black bread set up with piles of salt. And this was their sort of their version of energy goo. And so I tried it, and you know, and I had way too much salt, and my lips ballooned. And you know, the refreshments they provide is also you know, it was hot tea. You know,
not exactly what you're looking for.
Right.
We were chatting with Caleb at Haynes Point. It's a grassy spit of land in Washington, right near the Jefferson Memorial.
Go!
Runners come here to prepare for the annual Marine Corps Marathon, which is this weekend. That race goes by this very spot, and it evokes some strong memories in Caleb.
You know, this is about the halfway point, about 13.1 miles, and one of the things that really stands out to me about the Marine Corps Marathon was the number of wounded veterans that were running, young guys with no arms or one leg, or family members who had the iron-on dress portraits of Marines with the birth and death dates on them. You know, there was just sort of this huge feeling of there was a lot of damage that had been done, and there was a lot of healing that was taking place. So it was very powerful experience to be sort of surrounded by all these people who are sort of damaged, and it's just very nice to see running as a way to sort of move through that and sort of to try and transform beyond.
Transform beyond. Powerful words that capture what running has done for Caleb. One reason he notices the injuries other runners have is because he has some pretty deep wounds himself. Caleb grew up the son of an American journalist posted to Moscow. From his days in Moscow to college back in Vermont, Caleb struggled to connect with people, and he descended into alcoholism. He says running saved him.
A couple years into my recovery, I sort of evolved into a runner, and it became a major sobriety tool for me. It allowed me to get to know myself again, to do like some serious self-examination, honest self-examination. It injected sort of a spiritual element into my recovery. I used to run on this old dirt road before the sun came up, and the run would always end with the sunrise, so it was very kind of symbolic. And it also was a place where I started trying to make amends, trying to figure out the damage that I'd done and how to reach out to the people that were involved and how to apologize. So a lot of my apologies were drafted in my head, at 6 miles an hour, at 5 a.m. And so running for me became, it imposed a process. You really do need to have a process when you're getting sober, and a system of some kind. I mean, a lot of people do turn to AA. But for me, running gave me all those things and allowed me to sort of move through sobriety.
Tell me more about that. I mean, why does there need to be a process? Why is that so key to overcoming alcoholism?
Overcoming alcoholism is not the same thing as slapping on a nicotine patch. It's not a step-down thing and you're done after a couple months or after a year. It really is sort of a lifelong process. And, I got into a lot of trouble when I was drinking and drugging, and so I got sentenced to AA quite a bit, and so I was pretty familiar with their 12-step process and a lot of their philosophy, and I drew on bits and pieces of it. Things like, conducting a fearless moral inventory, that's something that you need to do. And that's something that I would do. I would feel that I could do at its most purest point when I was running. Just because when you're running, you just can't deceive yourself just because it's so hard. So your thought process is purer, I think. You also need to, like I was saying, make amends and figure out how to make those amends. There is sort of a spiritual transformation. I felt like I really cultivated an impulse toward humility, which was something I didn't have before. It's a softening of who you are and opening yourself up.
Cultivated an impulse toward humility. That's really powerful. And I guess I wonder why. Why was running a space where that, that happened for you?
I feel like you meet yourself again when you run. You break yourself down, and you're basically building yourself back up again. And I think it's the physical process. I just think the purity of thought that happens when you are really exerting yourself. You're just able to sort of tunnel in deeper. It allowed me to consider things that I hadn't considered before. It opens you up somehow. I don't know if it's the endorphins, but it gives you a space to both escape who you are and to burrow deeper into who you are.
Caleb, we're standing here and they're running a 3K, a 5K. We're going to start to see them finishing at the finish line soon. Have you reached the finish line somehow in your journey, or is there still kind of more of a race to run?
On one hand, I would say yes. On another sense, I feel like, you never really recover from anything fully. So you're always sort of in a state of recovery. And, in a way, that's the same thing as saying you're always sort of moving forward, trying to move forward. And I think you just you reach a point of peace inside yourself.
Caleb Daneloff, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot.
Caleb Daneloff's book is called Running Ransom Road. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.